Hello, it's Friday, July the 23rd. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we'll be talking about the opening of the Olympic Games. Is anybody really interested? I know I'm not. Also, we're talking about Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary. The government says there's no need to trawl through his private emails, even though he was using them to award contracts. Did you know Blue Monday, the last Monday in January, it's supposedly the worst day of the year? So we're now talking about the happiest day of the year. It's today. COVID passports, they're looking more and more likely to be defeated if the government tries to force a vote in the House of Commons. But first, great controversy over the measures excluding industries from the pingdemic. What happened to hospitality? What about priests and rabbis and imams? So the government has finally announced new measures exempting some people from the pingdemic, which continues to send people home. The move is intended to combat food shortages and to keep essential services up and running. But it's been met with dismay because excluded industries include hospitality, who say the sector is already struggling with staffing as so many of their workers are told to isolate. I'm joined now by Tony Sophoclides, who's Strategic Affairs Director at UK Hospitality. Tony, I thought there'd be at least a limited exclusion for your industry, but absolutely nothing at all. Were they not listening to you, or do they not get it?
It's difficult to know which of those it might be, to be honest. And we're certainly not going to give up on, you know, delivering the message to them. It is, you know, firstly, I should sort of start with a positive and say that it's great that, you know, those parts of the supply chain that have been included, because of course, you know, that's down the line, which you know, eventually comes to us, and we would certainly be in a bad position if we didn't have the food and beverages to serve our customers. But we're just going to have to keep going in terms of trying to make the case for the hospitality venues. I mean, it's a very wide, diverse sector that we have, but you know, by and large, one thing that they all have in common is that they do serve food and drink. So, you know, if we can't get that into people's mouths, then there's going to be a problem. But, you know, it comes, of course, you mentioned there that we have a staff shortage, and we had a staff shortage before the pandemic started anyway. So that was something we were already facing. It's just compounding it. And it's compounding it at a time when we're trying to, you know, make up some lost ground after what was about £90 billion worth of lost sales over the 15, 16 months when we were either not trading or trading a very limited capacity, and all the debts, you know, about £8 billion worth of debts in the sector to repay. So it's a real, real sort of awful time, just when many parts of hospitality, you know, hitting the summer peak season, or trying to.
Yeah, I was just about to say, the weather's, the sun's shining, obviously it won't last forever. It's an English summer, Welsh summer, Scottish summer, whatever. But this is a crucial time for you to try to start to restore some of the losses you've made over the last 15 months. How many businesses do you think, Tony, have already had to close or restrict their hours because their staff have been pinged by the dreaded app?
It's an unsatisfactory answer, but it's very difficult for us to know. And I think the thing to point, you know, the decisive factor here in most cases is the format of the venue, if you like. So, or not format, but the structure or the company structure. So if you have a single site pub, let's say, an independent pub, and your team are laid off, you just have to close. That's all there is. If you're, you know, if let's take again a pub or restaurant that's part of the chain, you've got at least a little bit of flexibility of shifting staff around. So whether it's an absolute closure or having to limit, you know, being limited to what you can do in terms of service, or having to, you know, you've heard some places having to limit a menu because they've only got one chef in and things like that. So it's across the board, really. It varies drastically, but, you know, the most drastic being having to shut down. And if, as, you know, seems almost certain, cases are going to continue to increase, then we're going to see one of two things. Either more closures, or, God forbid, people just stop using the app or ignoring the app, which, of course, is totally against the national public health objective that we all want to support, you know. So that would be a really quite horrific, and we certainly wouldn't, you know, advise anybody to do that. But people, you know, will start doing that, I think.
Some people say, oh, well, you've only got to get to August the 16th. That's when people who've been double jabbed will no longer have to automatically isolate if they're pinged. But George Eustace, the environment secretary, was saying that today. But I heard the business secretary speaking yesterday, and he hinted that August the 16th isn't set in concrete at all, and that date may be moved backwards. Now, that really would be trouble for your industry.
It would be trouble. It certainly would be. You're not wrong there. But, I mean, that also ignores the fact that even with 16th of August is not going to bring immediate succor to us, because we have 58% of our workforce are under the age of 35. So very many of those are not going to be double vaxxed anyway. So this is which is part of the reason why we're in such a pickle at the moment, because, you know, we can't see even on 16th of August that we're going to suddenly have full teams. It's, that's pretty much at the basis of our argument for having some sort of exemption. When I say exemption, what we're looking at here that would be pretty simple, I think, a fairly pragmatic solution would be that those who are fully vaccinated should be able to test after a ping and, subject to a negative result, carry on with their lives, yeah? Which is, not too much to ask. But because of our young workforce, I think that if we also had that augmented with those not fully vaccinated, if they have, a negative test upon pinging and then another one, say, 2 days later, that would at least go some way to easing the problem that we have. And I just don't think it's an unreasonable ask.
Your chief executive, Kate Nicholls, of course, has signed that Daily Mail letter, which we've organised from all sorts of people across the piece to try to get this sorted out. Are you confident that perhaps somebody in government may heed this, because so many people from so many different sectors of the economy are signing this letter?
I really hope so. I say it in that manner because you asked if I was confident. I'm hopeful rather than confident.
I think I get
things
that.
Like
yeah.
that. Things like the letter certainly will help. So we're grateful for that. I think it also helps to publicly display the sort of broad backing from across sectors for this. So, it's great to be able to have that vehicle. We have to live in hope. We've had such without hope, we'd have been nowhere over the last 16 months. So, we're going to keep pushing at that door and hoping that we can get somewhere, because, at the end of the day, it's going to come to a point where something breaks, and that's either closures or, as I say, hopefully not, a complete lack of faith in a very important app, an app that has a very important role to play.
Indeed. That's Tony Sophocledes. He's Strategic Affairs Director at UK Hospitality. Thanks for joining us. So visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So, following the resignation of the former Health Secretary Matt Hancock, it's now definitively emerged he was using a private email address for government business. This means the government does not have a record of how Hancock made decisions during the pandemic, including the negotiations of PPE contracts, the creation of track and trace, and care home strategy. The government is saying, however, it's not going to search the private email account of Hancock for any discussions on official business. Jodie Morme is director of the Good Law Project and has been calling for the government to do just that. And he joins me now. Why is it important, Mr. Morme, that we do know what Hancock was saying in those private emails? Can you explain in your inimitable way?
There are two issues, really. One is, these guys, it's Matt Hancock, it's Lord Bethell, it's former Trade Minister Greg Hands, it's Lord Dayton. These guys are all using private email addresses to conduct government business when they have proper public email addresses. And that raises an obvious question of, well, why? What's wrong with the official emails? And of course, you can't but wonder whether the answer to the why question is because they don't want civil service oversight. They don't want civil servants to know what they're doing. And the second issue is, well, now that we know that they're using private email addresses, why won't government look? It's not difficult to search private email addresses. We all do searches on our, Hotmail or our Outlook or our Gmail all of the time. It takes 30 seconds to type Pestfix or Iander into the search function, and it brings up some answers. It's not hard to do it. So why won't government do it? Lawyers have got a pretty good expression, actually. which is Nelsonian blindness. And it stems from Admiral Nelson being given the signal to retreat, him being told of this, and him putting the telescope to his blind eye and looking at the signalling ship and telling his naval colleague that he could see no signal. And there's a slight suspicion here that that is what government is doing. It's not searching because it does not want to see what was going on. As soon as government lawyers see what's going on, they have to tell us, and they'd rather not.
What can you, as director of the Good Law Project, do about this? Can you challenge this in court?
Yes. So in many of the individual judicial reviews that Good Law Project's bringing, we are going to make or have already made applications for specific disclosure of stuff in private email addresses or WhatsApps. But we're also bringing a sort of broader challenge in which we ask the government to change its practice so as to ensure that private email addresses, but also stuff like Signal messages and WhatsApps, are captured. I mean, amusingly, I've got Boris Johnson's phone number in my mobile and I have a Signal account. And I saw just a couple of days ago a message saying that Boris Johnson had joined Signal. I don't know why he joined Signal. Obviously, he's not able to conduct government business in the normal way. But, you know, if you speak to any special advisors, if you speak to politicians privately, they'll tell you that government by WhatsApp, by Proton Mail or Signal or Telegraph, whatever your sort of preferred messaging app is absolutely rampant. And the problem with it is civil servants cannot see what politicians are doing with public money. It's a really big problem.
The government say in their defence, in the course of a disclosure exercise, searched more than 1.4 million documents. They don't tell us which ones they are, and they don't tell us if any of those were the private emails of, as you say, Matt Hancock, his fellow health minister, Lord Bethell, Greg Hands, and Lord Dayton, who were two other ministers.
Well, I think it's worse than that, actually. I think they do tell us that they haven't searched those private email addresses. And they say that explicitly. They say that they haven't done it. And yes, they have done an awful lot of searches, but it is odd to me that they haven't searched the place where you would be most likely to find evidence of wrongdoing, if there was wrongdoing. And I can't but wonder what the reason is for them cutting out that place. You know, it's like if you're looking for your house keys, and like me, you usually put them in a bowl just inside the front door, and looking for your house keys, but you will not look in that bowl. I mean, that's the obvious place to look for evidence as to why these deals, many of them, and Pesfix and Iander I mentioned already, were on VIP lanes. Many of these deals on VIP lanes. Why are you not looking in the private email addresses of ministers?
Just finally, of course, they must all be keen students of history. They must recall the great difficulties Hillary Clinton got into in her own presidential race against Donald Trump, because it emerged that she'd used her own private email address when she was the American Secretary of State. And it raised the same question, what did she have to hide? And it caused her enormous damage.
Yes. And I mean, I regret, actually, that I didn't pay more attention to that story. I didn't understand at the time quite how important it was. And, you know, we've got a pretty big recent scandal here. A journalist called Chris Cook had a long fight with Michael Gove and Dominic Cummings, when Dominic Cummings was Michael Gove's special advisor, to get them to release information on government business that was being conducted then by private email. I think what's changed really now is that the scale of government spending, the scale of government business done during the pandemic, and the absence of any normal process, you know, for reasons that are explicable, but still the absence of any normal process means that the use of government by WhatsApp or Telegraph or Signal or private email addresses is particularly worrying.
Indeed, I think this is one, as they say in the trade, it will run and run. That's Jolyon Maugham, Director of the Good Law Project. Thanks so much for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. So the government's announced plans to introduce a vaccine passport, which they say they will use as a way to keep people safe in crowds at nightclubs and potentially even bars. But a cross-party group of MPs, including the Tory Steve Baker, is pledging to vote down the scheme. Labour also says the passport will be expensive and prone to fraud and will also oppose it. Campaign groups say the passport will be discriminative and divisive. Jim Killock is Executive Director of the Open Rights Group. Jim, we talked about this before. You're no fan of this in any shape or form, are you?
No, I think this is a really poor idea. And I think by the time that it even becomes possible to implement, it'll probably be way beyond the point where it's especially useful. I mean, the government seems to be trying to use it to sort of bludgeon young people into getting the vaccine. And I think that also is a really bad thing. People should not feel coerced into having the vaccine. They should do it because it's a good idea and sensible and helps them get on with their daily lives. So there should be incentives for this rather than essentially attempts to penalise people.
Say that is an incentive, that if you want to go to a nightclub, people under 30 want to go to nightclubs. Yeah. Get jabbed, and then you get your passport.
No, I don't think that's an incentive. That's essentially it's a kind of push, isn't it? Well, you know, I think the kind of incentives people should have are, you know, the ability to not have to self isolate, or you know, have an easier time when you know the pandemic is therefore you know, problematic. That's the kind of incentive which I think everyone would appreciate right now. You know, we're looking at the so-called pandemic, and you know, people who've been vaccinated are kind of annoyed because they don't feel like they need to self-isolate. Well, that's a huge incentive. You can get out of self-isolation, and given the number that a lot of young people are in the sort of industries and jobs where they do have a lot of face-to-face contact, I think that's a much more sensible way of tackling this problem and trying to help people through it. Some countries have also considered financial benefits. I mean, I think those are the kind of things where people, you know, essentially get new privileges rather than having them taken away and being told they can't get on with their social lives and so on. And I think also, you know, in any case, I expect that the government will be able to have a reasonably successful vaccine rollout, because I'm sure word will get around that this is not a pleasant disease. Also, the government needs to concentrate on telling people how difficult it is for people who get long COVID. You know, young people are just as likely to end up with long-term symptoms, which is very damaging for their employment prospects. You know, it's often involving people taking months off work. Those are, you know, that's the education piece, isn't it? That's how you persuade young people to get the vaccine, because it's something like one in six people that are getting long COVID. That's an awful lot of people, and a very, very good reason to get vaccinated.
I wonder if the thing that will actually kill this off, Jim, is the idea that people may have to have a COVID passport to go to the Conservative Party conference. Trust me, I've been going to them for 30 years. Tory MPs don't need much excuse not to go. This may be just the thing they've got to say, stuff that, I'm not going because I don't want a COVID passport.
Well, I think that does give exactly the problem. I mean, you know, political events, they involve a lot of people, but are we really saying that you can't express your political opinions, that you're not to make your own judgments about whether or not you've been vaccinated in order to get into these political events? I mean, I think you have to find more proportionate ways of moving forward. At the time that COVID passports seemed like they may be necessary, the point where it was kind of possible to think about how this might work and why it might be necessary, or the government might consider it necessary, I think we were not really envisaging a world where most or nearly everybody had got vaccinated. We're in a very strange transition period at the moment where not enough people have been vaccinated to suppress the disease. And the government's trying to finish that process, quite rightly. And, you know, at this point, the whole question of how you manage society is still in play. But by the time they've got to a point where vaccine passports are implementable, we'll be put more or less out of that. So, I'm, you know, most people will have been vaccinated, and it'll be just a question of persuading the last few. And as I say, there are plenty of ways to do that. So I'm not really sure that this is ever really going to need to be necessary. And I think that's another reason why people are kind of opposing it, because they, you know, people don't want to have very restrictive policies implemented if they're simply not really going to be needed. That's the point we're at, I think. You know, it's going to become a diminishing problem this over the next few weeks and months.
Let's hope you're right. That's Jim Killick. He's the Executive Director of Open Rights Group on the very deep problems with the COVID passport. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here with the latest sports news. Matt, the Olympic opening ceremony is underway, or has been underway. I really couldn't give a hoot. Now, why normally I get caught up in the Olympic fervour? Is it just because we've had a summer of sports, so this one has almost passed under the radar? Is it because no fans are there, no spectators? It seems a little bit underwhelming.
Yeah, well, it's obviously a massively unusual Olympics. Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors, really. I think it's hot on the heels of the Euros, which we've only just recovered from our loss on that.
We still haven't recovered.
Well, we haven't recovered, but
I still haven't recovered.
Right,
Matt.
Okay. Well, some of us are still trying to come to terms with our our defeat on the penalty.
You haven't come to terms with it. You have not come to terms with it.
I put it in a little box to deal with at a later date, I think.
And you've got to deal with these things, Matt.
I know. So, yeah, I think it's partly that. It's partly, obviously, that this Olympics is weird in as much as a lot of the general public in Japan do not want this Olympics to be going on. So, obviously, because they're worried about the spread of COVID. So it's kind of like the unwelcome games, the unwanted games almost. You know, and I think that's been the background to this, and almost the kind of will it, won't it? You know, there's been a lot of debate about whether it will even happen or not. And all the way up until this week. So the fact that we're now having the opening ceremony has kind of crept up on a few people. So I think that's kind of what's behind it all. But I think you'll find as it goes, and as, you know, the medals start to pour in and the athletes do their thing, we will get behind it and we will get excited in it and we will get interested in it. Obviously, it's not going to be the same because there's not going to be any fans there. So it's not going to be quite the spectacle that a normal Olympics would be. But I do think once these athletes start doing their thing, you know, even you might be won over to actually watch it. The other problem, or the other thing about it is it's on. Some of it is on through the night, so you'll be waking up and seeing and hearing about what's happened overnight. So that's going to be a slight thing that's not on, you know, your sort of prime time TV. But you know, it does continue into the following day, so you'll still have plenty of chance to catch up with the action.
And it's the Lions. It's the first test. We're playing South Africa, presumably.
We are. So again, this has been all the talk about this tour is will it, won't it? Will it happen? Won't it happen? And again, there's no fans, unfortunately, in South Africa. Normally, the Lions take a huge contingent of British fans over to wherever they're playing, be it South Africa, New Zealand or Australia. And it becomes this beautiful festival of fun and people watching the Lions and seeing how they're going to get on. Now, obviously, we won't have that, but we will have two teams who, after all this, will it, won't it, will be absolutely desperate to go at one another. There's been lots of pre-series chat. There's been the two coaches going at each other. There's been accusations made about bad tackling from both teams. So there's been all the phony war and all the build-up, and now finally tomorrow we're due to start. Now, it's going to be a big bruising encounter. This Springbok side, of course, won the World Cup, beat England in the final, so there'll be a few England players there who are looking for a bit of revenge for that. And there's also, you know, there's going to be lots of opportunities for people to make their mark on this series. So it's going to be exciting. It's an unusual team that Warren Gatland has chosen. There's some people who've never played together before for the Lions in certain combinations. So it's going to be fascinating to watch and see whether the Lions can beat these massive Springbok team.
Well, you preempted my final question. You know what it is.
Oh, no, not this again.
Yes.
If you put me on the spot here,
As I am putting you on the spot here.
As you do. Well, I'm going to go for the Springboks to win this one, I'm afraid, by 3 points. I think it's going to be tight, but I think the Springboks might just nick it. And I think that could be then difficult for the Lions for the rest of the series. I hope I'm wrong, but last time I went with my heart and not my head, and I got it wrong. So this time I'm going to go with my head, not my heart.
All down the bookies, put money on the Lions.
Indeed. Lump on.
That's our deputy sports editor, the wonderful Matt Gatwood. The brains behind so-called Blue Monday, which is the most miserable day of the year, has flipped the science on its head to identify the day when the nation's hearts are most likely to soar. It's being labelled Feel Good Friday, and it's today, Friday, July the 23rd, which might explain why you're feeling a bit more cheerful. The discovery is all down to a combination of thank goodness it's Friday feeling, after Freedom Day, good weather, long daylight hours, payday, school break, and the start of summer holidays. The psychologist, Dr. Cliff Arnold, came up with Blue Monday, and he's come up with the new Feel Good Friday. Are we all, I mean, do you really think we're all going to be feeling a lot better by the end of the day, Doctor?
I think it's more likely than other days for a number of reasons. We've got the list that you've just given there. So it is actually a very special week for certainly for England, at least, in terms of there are more freedoms now. There's more places to go and visit. So that's a definite plus. But there's also information from the research literature, which is actually very well respected, and including Cornell, Harvard, and University College London, that feeds into the formula that I've developed for the Appreciate group.
You've actually got a mathematical formula which can be summed up as N plus S plus F2 plus P plus A times SK dash SM, the most joyful day of 2021. It's that simple. It's never simple to me if it involves mathematics, Doctor. What does that mean?
Okay, well, it's a formula. So it's about a way of representing an idea. And what we have are seven factors within this brand new formula. Six of them are positive. One of them is a negative. And the idea is that this is designed to be very practical. So based on my experience as a psychologist over 25 years and the literature that I just mentioned, we have these seven factors.
So nature being in full bloom, that's the N, plus S, that's the sunshine, plus F2, family and friends. Combine all that with attitudes more likely to be turning to normality, and so it goes on. I'm intrigued by it, Doctor, because Blue Monday, the last Monday in January, why is that all such a bad day, such a bad day?
Well, again, for the factors that appear in that formula, there's never been any dispute that people feel particularly down around that time. And again, that's not surprising, because the data was collected from a wide range of regular people, and again backed up by some of the literature. The formula we're talking about today, this most joyful day of the year, again is the same basis, is what real people, thousands of real people, have been telling me over the years, and also the most recent research.
Right. I'm just going back to your formula. You say combine all those positive factors with self-kindness. Now, what is self-kindness?
Well, we hear a lot about kindness to others, and that is wonderful and very good for you. Actually, psychologically, it's good for you. But what's omitted from that, and I'm meeting more and more clients, running more groups, where people kind of relegate themselves in terms of kindness, so that they appear, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh on the list of people that they're, you know, who receive the kindness. And I want to encourage people to be gentle and kind with themselves, not just other people. I mean, if you flip that on its head, the opposite of self-kindness, in my experience, is self-criticism. And there are a lot of people who really don't feel that good about themselves. They don't think they're good enough. They don't think they're worthy. And I think it's about time that people had a go. And it's not going to change overnight. But to have a little think about, how can I be kind? How can I be respectful? How can I be gentle to myself?
And what I thought was really, really interesting in your formula, so we've got N plus S plus F2 minus SM. Of course, SM is social media. So you think social media is not a force for good on a nice day like today. Because we're all feeling more upbeat and cheerful, you think we'll look at social media less. Is that your theory?
Yeah, there's two strands. One is we're less likely to be on social media because we're going to be socializing more with real people and doing real things, rather than, obviously, we've all been in a virtual world for a good while now. So I think that automatically will reduce the reliance, if you like, on social media. But I think there's another element here as well. Whenever I speak to people who use social media regularly, they freely admit, they go, do you know what, I am on it too long. I wish I wasn't on it so long. And again, research has backed this up. There's in the Neuroscience Institute in the US just 3 years ago. The thing that's interesting about this study is that the average age of the participants was 44 years old. Typically, it tends to be 16, 17, 18 years old, a lot of the research. So this interested me. And of the sample, 70% of participants used social media when they were going to bed to sleep. And of that 70%, 15% spent over an hour a night on social media when they actually said they wanted to be asleep. Now, that's very interesting, particularly when those same people do exactly the same the following night. So they know that they shouldn't be doing this, that it's affecting their energy levels, their concentration for the next day, and yet they carry on doing it. Well, that's kind of a definition of an addiction. So another group of researchers, maybe wince when I heard this, they suggest and recommend a limit of 30 minutes a day for social media.
Interesting. That would do me, because I look at Twitter for about 1 minute. I'm so appalled by all the abuse, I go off it.
I thought for a minute there you were going to say that you had no friends, so it didn't matter.
there is that as well, of course. There is that. So okay. So it's Feel Good Friday. It sounds a great day. And are you doing anything yourself, Doctor, to mark good Feel Good Friday? Are you taking somebody special in your life to dinner or doing something nice tonight?
No, the most special thing I've done so far is to walk in the garden in bare feet.
Well, I think that sounds great. That's the psychologist, Dr. Cliff Arnold, on why today is a very special day. It's Feel Good Friday. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.